From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
They tried to make me go to rehab, I said no, no, no.
Today, we talk about the new Amy Winehouse documentary with Nick Shemansky, who discovered Winehouse and later convinced her to go to rehab.
On the condition that I took her to her father's house and she got his consent and his approval.
We also talk with Asif Kapadia, who directed the film.
Her father didn't think she needed to go, that's why she didn't go. And then you realise, actually, that real incident, Amy turned into a song which became her biggest hit, which became the albatross around her neck.
Also, David Thorpe talks about his documentary called...
Do I sound gay?
It's about Thorpe's attempts to sound less gay. And Justin Chang reviews Tangerine, the new film about transgender prostitutes in Los Angeles.
Out here, it is all about our hustle. And that's it.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Amy Winehouse was just 27 years old when she died in 2011 from causes related to drugs, alcohol, and bulimia. By that time, Winehouse was nearly as famous for her problems as she was for her music. She'd become the butt of late-night jokes and was stalked by paparazzi. The new documentary, called Amy, tries to rescue Winehouse from that narrative, find out who she was before she was famous, and trace how drugs and fame transformed her. The film is told through interviews with friends, family, and people with whom Winehouse worked in the music world. Earlier this week, Terry Gross interviewed Asif Kapadia, who directed the documentary Amy, and Nick Shemansky, who discovered Amy Winehouse, became her first manager, and worked with her for 7 years. Shemansky is now a vice president at Island Records. Terry began her interview with a clip from Amy, recorded when Winehouse was in her early teens at the birthday party of her 14-year-old friend. Winehouse sings the lead vocal on this chorus of Happy Birthday.
It's my 14th birthday evening in
Batty.
Welcome, Asif Kapadia and Nick Shemansky. So, Asif, tell us how you managed to get that footage when Amy Winehouse was 14 years old and at her friend's birthday party.
So that material came from one of Amy Winehouse's best friends, Lauren Gilbert. Lauren's family seemed to film everything, so a lot of their holidays and birthdays and parties and things like that. And Amy was in the footage all along because they were very good friends from a very young age. The process of getting the material was a very long-winded one, which came from building up a relationship and trust with all of the people I spoke to making the film. And I spoke to the people originally just by doing audio interviews, getting to know people, getting to trust them, and then sitting down recording audio interviews. And once they trusted me enough and had opened up about their story and their relationship to Amy, they then started to give us personal footage, answer phone messages, home videos, holiday videos, photographs, you know, all sorts of little bits and pieces which we sort of pieced together to create this giant mosaic of Amy's life.
Now, you had trouble convincing people to talk openly with you about Amy Winehouse, and I assume that's because the people who were close with her were very protective of her, especially considering how the paparazzi and the tabloids just took over so much of her life and made it so difficult for her to have a life. Nick, why did you agree to talk to Asif Kapadia about Amy Winehouse, and had you been protective about talking with her before?
Yeah, I mean, I'd never spoken to anyone publicly about Amy, and at the particular time I heard about rumours that this film had been commissioned and was being made, I was in a sort of bad space in my head with it all, feeling quite overprotective and a bit closed about everything. I'd spent time with Lauren and Juliet, Amy's two closest friends, after Amy's death, and we all felt very much closed outside the kind of official spokespeople or the official channels for Amy. But I did know about Asif as a filmmaker, and so I felt like instead of it being relayed to him down another conversation, you know, down the phone through someone else, I should at least meet up with him and explain why I don't think the film, you know, why I don't want to be involved, and why possibly it's a bit early for the film.
So what did you tell him when you explained why you did not want to be involved?
Well, I just said that I felt the two biggest things for me was, one, it felt too early, which now I completely feel different about. And also, I was just very cynical about anyone being able to tell the story without glossing over some big parts of the story, and possibly without being overly controlled. So, you know, I think I was quite honest with Asif about that. And what I was really pleasantly surprised at from meeting Asif and getting together with him was how sort of calm and relaxed he was. There was the whole tact felt very sensitive, and nothing around Amy for the last few years of her life and post her death felt at all sensitive. And then the absolute moment where I decided, you know what, I think this guy and this team are really solid, was when I went into the editing suite and I saw this timeline going round the editing suite with the years and months of Amy's life. And although it was kind of shocking to see something so practical put to such an emotional story or emotional to me, I've thought, wow, this team are really dedicated to trying to get this right and to trying to have a look into who's who and what's what and what happened. And I guess from that moment on, I thought, you know what? No one's put the time into Amy. No one of any intellect has really got stuck into this story. This is probably if I'm ever going to do this, it's probably now, and it's probably with this guy, Asif.
I want to play something that's in the movie Amy from early in her career. And this is her singing a song that she ends up doing on her first album, or perhaps she's singing this after the first album was released. You can help me with the chronology. And the song is called Stronger Than Me. This is her singing this at a club. Where does this performance come from? Who recorded it and where?
This was the first run of promotional activity. We got invited to the club and it was televised. So it was very early on in her promoting the first album.
You just see her with a guitar. I mean, one of the big revelations for me, there's lots of revelations making this film. I didn't realise how funny she was. I didn't realise she played a guitar. I didn't realise, you know, she had this amazing personality. And so from very early on, this footage, it's very simple. It's just in a club. There's lots of voices and people are chatting in the background. Amy with a guitar is electric. You know, she's just amazing. And you just see the talent, the rawness of it all. And this clip really shows you. It's very early on in her career. People don't know who she is, but the word in kind of certain circles, people are hearing about this girl's voice and her talent. And I think that kind of sums it up, really.
So this is Amy Winehouse around 2003?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, here we go.
Yourself be stronger than me. You'll be here 7 years longer than me. Don't you know you're supposed to be the man? Not a pale in comparison to who you think I am. You're always gonna talk it through. I don't care. I always have to comfort you where I'm there. But that's what I need you to do.
So that's some footage from the new documentary, Amy. That was Amy Winehouse singing at a club in 2003. My guests are Asif Kapadia, who directed the movie, and Nick Szymanski, who was Amy Winehouse's first manager and is one of the main interviewees in the movie. So many of her songs were autobiographical. Does that song, Stronger Than Me, tell a story about a boy in her life, a man in her life?
Yeah, I mean, that was... She was writing that song was written in Miami just after she, in fact, I think she may have even been going out with the guy at the time she wrote the song. But was a guy that she pursued for quite a long time that I don't think was very interested in her. And then she finally won him over and it went the other way. He was extremely interested in her and she started to lose interest in him. That's a song that came after she'd written some really warm songs towards the guy as well. So it really captures both sides of her personality, her sort of tender side, but also her more witty side.
Many young performers are driven to become stars, but my impression from the documentary about Amy Winehouse is that she was almost afraid of stardom, that she thought it would hurt her, and in fact, it did. So, Nick, when you knew her, when she was first starting in her career and you were managing her, what were your impressions of what she wanted out of her career?
For me, I was so sort of excited to find someone of that talent, and there was quite quickly a really strong chemistry between her and I. And I realized that she, you know, with Amy, it was about finding the things that would make her feel focused. So early on, you know, I suppose if I look back in hindsight, you know, she wasn't that ambitious to be famous and she wasn't ambitious to make lots of money, but she was very ambitious to get in the studio with some, you know, top level musicians. She was really excitable when it came to making music, being around music. So I guess that masked at the time my understanding of what her ambition was, because there was motivation and there was enthusiasm. And I guess years later, I look at it and I realize that was never directed at fame or money or the things that come with being a big star. But it wasn't so obvious because of those other things that were going on.
Her most famous song, at least in the U.S., is Rehab. And Nick, you're a part of that story. You wanted to take her to rehab. In fact, you performed an intervention with her. Would you just tell us that story?
She was in a bad place and it'd been going on for a while. I was very worried about her. It had been long enough to realize that this wasn't just a phase. So myself, Juliet and Lauren, we sort of rallied together and it resulted in me taking her to rehab. She went to meet someone at rehab, agreed to go in on the condition that I took her to her father's house and she got his consent and his approval. I obviously stopped, called him to kind of just make sure he was on the same page. He agreed he was on the same page. By the time we got to the house, that had, you know, he changed his mind and sort of, if anything, went against the idea of her going to rehab.
And so the line in the song, "I ain't got the time, and if my daddy says I'm fine," that leads to "I won't go." So that's like a factual reference that her father said she didn't need to go to rehab.
That song's pretty much verbatim what happened that day. I mean, it was all lined up for her to go, and who knows what would have happened, whether it would have worked or not, I don't know. But we had it all lined up, and he changed his mind, and if anything, belittled my position and also my point of view, made out as though I was massively overreacting, which was a terrible message to give to her as well, I felt at the time.
As if Amy Winehouse's father, Mitch Winehouse, objects to how he's portrayed in this part of the movie. And he thinks that his full statement was edited in such a way that so that the full intent of what he's saying isn't represented. Do you want to address that?
Well, I think he said at the time, "I don't think she needs to go to rehab." He is saying, it's quite pedantic, I think he's saying in his interview, and we did more than one interview, he said, "I don't think Amy needed to go to rehab at the time." Now, he's saying you've taken out "at the time," but the point was, at that time, he didn't think she needed to go to rehab, and that's what we've got in the film, and that's what Amy says in the song. I mean, what you've just been talking to Nick about is actually a kind of interesting part of the creation of this film. I was meeting people and talking to them, and while talking to them, it dawns on me, oh my God, Nick, you're talking about something I've heard of. I know this song. And then you realise, actually, that real incident, Amy turned into a song which became a biggest hit, which became the albatross around her neck. it's the song that made her famous in the US. It made her famous around the world. And then later on, people watched her singing it with a glass of wine in her hand or, you know, a vodka. And you're sitting there dancing to it. But this is a cry for help in a way. This is her sort of trying to have a dig, or in hip hop terminology, she's dissing Nick in a way. People trying to help her. She turned it into a song. And I kind of find it slightly, it doesn't matter what whether it was said at the time or not. Her father didn't think she needed to go. That's why she didn't go.
So why don't we hear Amy Winehouse singing Rehab from her 2007 album, Back to Black.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time. And if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab.
That's the big Amy Winehouse hit, Rehab, recorded in 2007. And my guests are the director of the new documentary about her, Asif Kapadia. The documentary is called Amy. And Nick Szymanski, who was her first manager. He managed her for 7 years. And that relationship as manager and musician ended just before the release of the album Back to Black. So, Nick, what was it like for you hearing that song, knowing like, yeah, you're the guy who really tried to get her into rehab? And her father did say she didn't need that at the time. And now she has a song about it, and the song sounds kind of funny in a way. Like, yeah, I don't have to go.
Well, it was a very frustrating time because I could hear what a powerful hit song it was. I knew it was a song that would travel. At the same time, I was slightly embarrassed because it was making a mockery out of me and what I stood for. But the biggest feeling was of sadness and frustration because I knew she did need to go. And I knew that by the time the actual record was coming out, she was in a worse place. And by the time everyone knew the song, she was in an even worse place. There's a lyric in it, It's Not Just My Pride, which really resonated with me because, you know, my pride was in a bad place because someone that I had this big dream for was sort of going into the dream and I was no longer part of it. And I could see it turning into a nightmare pretty quickly.
Asif, there's a story in your documentary, Amy, about her being in the studio, recording the songs for her album Back to Black, when she's drinking in the studio, and she also has this like huge plate of food that she finishes plus a dessert, and then goes into the bathroom, and one of the women discovers that she threw everything up because she was bulimic, but no one really understood that at the time. So even though the people who were recording her at the time thought maybe that she was sober, she still had very serious troubling issues going on in the studio.
We found out that, you know, bulimia was an issue from a young age, from like her teens, mid-teens. And I think that's what came out. A lot of different people had mentioned they'd noticed it, but they didn't realise it's a big deal, or they thought it was a passing phase or, you know, nervousness. And that was a massive part of Amy's kind of illness over the years, which mixed with alcohol. And obviously there was a period of heavy drugs, but that was really a problem for her. There was an eating disorder that continued all the way through. And really people started to notice it more and more. But what I found was that lots of different people would notice it, but nobody was talking to one another. And I think that was a big revelation about the kind of Amy story, was that the different compartments to her life, different people in different stages that didn't meet or talk to one another, or in certain cases just didn't get along. And I think, therefore, Amy was able to control the situation by not everyone knew all of the information.
Well, you know, her mother, Amy Winehouse's mother, even tells you when you're interviewing her that Amy had come to her when she was in her, I think, early teens and said, I have this great way of dieting. I just like eat whatever I want and then I just kind of bring it up. And her mother tells you that she didn't think much of it at the time. She thought, oh, she's a teenager. It's a passing phase. It'll go away. No big deal.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the sadder things when you hear her mother talking, who, you know, she's very sweet, Janice, but she's, you know, she's talked about how even when Amy was very young, Amy would ask her mother to be tougher on her. Be stronger with me. You know, I need a bit of more kind of guidance. And Amy's mother wasn't always able to be like that. It doesn't come naturally to her. So I think, yeah, she mentioned it. That was, again, another thing where you realise that from 15, 16, she'd mentioned it to her parents, and they didn't know how to handle it.
Let's talk a little bit about the paparazzi. She was the target of paparazzi. And the sicker that she got, the more drug problems that she had, the more people wanted to photograph her in any kind of compromised situation. And so you have shots from multiple points of view. It seems to me you probably got footage and still photographs from different paparazzi of the same moment in her life, of that same street that she was walking down or door she was coming out of. You have points of view from several different photographers. Why did you want to do that, and how did you get the photographs and footage from the paparazzi?
I lived half a mile away from Amy's front door. I knew that area very well. And, you know, this crazy life that she led, where she'd walk out of her door to get to a taxi cab, she'd have to pass by 50, 60 men, you know, with these cameras flashing photographs at her. And she's a tiny, petite girl. And it just seemed nuts that this was normal. This became normal. So I felt we had to deal with that and show that.
Was it hard to get paparazzi to agree to hand over their photographs and footage?
I think the way this works is once you start talking to people, if they still exist, I mean, a lot of paparazzi take the picture, it gets sent out, it gets used by a newspaper, and then they delete it. So a lot of material has been lost. I mean, the interesting thing that we should mention is Amy was the girl with the album, with that particular song, Rehab, who was famous when in the UK all the newspapers went digital. So suddenly there were websites. Suddenly, you know, all of those kind of pop culture websites or, you know, the glamour ones, they're the ones that are the most popular. People want photos. Amy sold newspapers. If she was on the cover of a tabloid, it sold more copies. If she was on a website, they got more hits.
Nick, Amy was supposed to come to your wedding, and she died the day before your wedding. I'm wondering how close you were to her then. You know,
I adored Amy, and you know, I had a real soft spot for her from the first time I met her. I had a blind belief that she was the best. I spoke to her, you know, a few months before she passed, and she made it really clear she'd really like to be at my wedding, which I was pleasantly surprised at. And so I said, "Of course, you know, goes without saying, you're welcome to my wedding." And I'd heard from her two or three times, and I'd heard from people around her, you know, that she was really excited about my wedding. And I had a lot of people due to be at the wedding or at the wedding that knew Amy well and that had known Amy for a long time. And so you can imagine the day before my wedding, you know, it's one of the happiest weekends of my life to get probably some of the saddest news I've ever received in my life. Was a, you know, it couldn't have been worse.
Nick Szymanski was Amy Winehouse's first manager and is now a vice president at Island Records. He's interviewed in the new documentary Amy, which was directed by Asif Kapadia. You can hear a longer version of their conversation with Terry Gross on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair.
I'm lecturing. I just want to do my thing. And I'll take the wrong man as naturally as I sing. And I'll save my tears for uncovering my fears. Our behavioral patterns stick over the years. Cause it's pricked up in my head. It's shoved under my bed. And I question myself again. Why this is about me?
The new film Tangerine is about two transgender prostitutes spending Christmas Eve on the streets of Los Angeles. It's the latest from director Sean Baker, whose last movie, the 2012 drama Starlet, cast a sympathetic eye on a little-seen corner of the Southern California sex industry. Film critic Justin Chang says Baker has done it again with Tangerine.
When Tangerine premiered 6 months ago at the Sundance Film Festival, it quickly became known as the movie that was shot entirely on a smartphone. It's the sort of talking point that makes Sean Baker's raw and exuberant ensemble comedy seem a lot more gimmicky than it really is. And it doesn't begin to account for how gorgeous the movie looks. No matter how many films you've seen set in Los Angeles, the city has never looked quite so searingly alive as it does in Tangerine, which is set over several crime-riddled streets in the Hollywood area, where Highland Avenue meets Santa Monica Boulevard. It's not a part of town you'd probably care to visit, unless you were in the market for a very particular kind of transaction. The kind that Tangerine lays bare with matter-of-fact honesty and disarming humor. Set over the course of one hot and sunny Christmas Eve, the story centers around two black transgender prostitutes named Alexandra and Cindy. They're played by two black transgender actresses, Maya Taylor and Kitana Kiki Rodriguez, who collaborated heavily on the script with Baker and his co-writer, Chris Bergock. This is the first time that Taylor and Rodriguez have ever appeared on camera, but it would be difficult to imagine a more naturally gifted comic duo, or a more tender and resilient portrait of friendship. Tangerine is a warts-and-all immersion in one of L.A.'s seamier subcultures, and a terrific girlfriend movie to boot. The story begins with Cindy, that's short for Cindy-rella, hanging out at her favorite spot, a hole-in-the-wall called Donut Time. It's there that her best friend, Alexandra, accidentally drops a bombshell. Cindy's boyfriend-slash-pimp, Chester, has been cheating on her with someone named Dinah. Making matters worse, Dinah isn't a transgender woman, but a biological female, which for Cindy is the ultimate insult.
So, I got some good news to tell you.
What?
I've been keeping a secret about me and Chester.
Girl. Woo! I know what it is! Okay. You're breaking up with him. Thank God. Because, what? Honey, for him to be cheating on you like that...
Wait, what?
You didn't know?
The rest of the conversation, and indeed the rest of the movie, is filled with the sort of vividly colorful language that I couldn't even begin to repeat on the air. The vulgarities never let up as Cindy goes on a rampage in search of those who have wronged her, an avenging dark angel in a fabulous blonde wig and cheetah print crop top. Meanwhile, Alexandra has a few errands of her own to take care of, and while she's more demure than Cindy, she's not one to back down from a street fight when a John refuses to pay up. But she has reliable customers as well, like a male Armenian-American cab driver named Razmik, beautifully played by Karen Karagulian. There may be no more poignant or more honest sex scene this year than the one that unfolds inside Razmik's taxi as it moves through a car wash. It's a bracing image of two lonely souls trapped by their circumstances, meeting their needs the only way they can. As he demonstrated in his previous film, Starlet, about the unlikely friendship that develops between a 21-year-old aspiring porn actress and a woman in her 80s, Baker has an affinity for lives lived in the margins of polite society. Here, as in that earlier film, he pulls you in so close you can all but feel the heat rising from the sidewalk. What's remarkable about Radium Cheung's cinematography isn't just the image quality he achieves on an iPhone 5S, but the extraordinary intimacy and mobility of the camera as it chases Alexandra and Cindy from one location to the next. The movie's finest sequences have a marvelous spontaneity, none more so than a terrifically over-the-top climax where the movie's various characters converge, including the elusive Chester himself, played by James Ransone with the same scene-stealing verve he brought to HBO's The Wire. Tangerine emerges at a moment when the transgender community is enjoying greater visibility than ever, from the Amazon series Transparent to the real-life saga of Caitlyn Jenner. Yet to simply lump Baker's film together with other such stories would seem awfully reductive. As played by Taylor and Rodriguez, the characters of Alexandra and Cindy are so specific and so bursting with life that they stand alone. And so does the movie itself, which manages to be at once wildly funny and painfully honest about the everyday degradation and inhumanity that its characters experience. It's this sympathy for every avenue of the minority experience that gives Tangerine such a powerful sense of purpose. What could have been a raggedy little group portrait somehow transforms, by film's end, into a sprawling and hopeful vision of humanity.
Justin Chang is chief film critic at Variety. He reviewed the new film, Tangerine. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with David Thorpe, director of the documentary film, Do I Sound Gay? Thorpe is gay and has no problem with being out, but he does, or at least did, have a problem with his voice. He thought it sounded annoying and stereotypically gay. His way of dealing with the issue of his voice was to make a documentary. The film, which Thorpe narrates, follows him as he seeks insights and advice from speech therapists and linguists and talks to gay friends about his voice and theirs. Thorpe also talks to several gay people who have very familiar voices, including David Sedaris, Tim Gunn, Dan Savage, and George Takei. One of the voice experts Thorpe consults, Susan Sankin, also joins the conversation we're about to hear. Sankin is a language and speech pathologist whose clients include actors, public speakers, and non-native speakers. Let's begin with a clip from Do I Sound Gay? Here's how the documentary opens.
Do I sound gay?
Yes, I think you do sound gay. Not as much as I do, but...
Yes. Yes.
No. En français, no. In English, I don't know.
Yes.
Not at all.
Really?
It's your tone, which is, like, intellectual, so people can read it as gay.
I would have just maybe lumped you in the artsy-fartsy.
Sound creative.
You have, like, the S in the front of the mouth, which is part of the gay man stereotype.
There is something slightly melodic.
I think it's the nasality.
I would definitely rate you as a metrosexual.
No.
Not at all.
No.
You sound like a human being male.
Je sais pas.
It's perhaps more the fact that I'm gay as well, so I kind of pick up on that.
You don't sound like gay, maybe because I'm steeped in gay.
You could sound gay if you wanted to make it a very, very cast a very wide net.
We enunciate, and if that's gay, mwah.
That was Tim Gunn throwing the kiss at the end of that opening collage from the movie Do I Sound Gay? David Thorpe, welcome to Fresh Air. Susan Sankin, welcome to Fresh Air. David, you realize that as you talk, all of us listening to you will be evaluating, does he sound gay? I don't know. What does gay mean? And what does gay sound mean? And that might distract us from what you're actually saying. So
I'm used to it. It's okay.
So why did you start thinking, or perhaps more accurately, worrying about whether you sounded gay and what that meant?
Well, I've always been self-conscious about sounding gay, and I think that that comes from childhood. I grew up in the 80s, which was a less accepting time for LGBT people. And as Dan Savage says in the movie, effeminate kids, whether they are gay or straight, get persecuted for kind of how they walk and how they talk. And for me, I was always aware that my voice potentially kind of gave me away to bullies. When I'm not confident in my life for whatever reason, sometimes kind of those feelings of shame and stigma resurface. And I was prompted to make the film after I broke up with someone I was very much in love with and feeling like a loser, for lack of a better word. I was in my 40s and single and thought, like, why can't I still find love? And a lot of that, a lot of that vulnerability and shame about sort of my worth as a person resurfaced. And on top of it, I started to find myself repelled by gay voices. I had a lightning bolt moment on a trip to Fire Island after the breakup, and I should have been excited to be going to this place where I could heal and swim and be with my gay tribe. But instead, I found myself kind of repelled by these chattering gay voices around me. And It was a real lightning bolt because I felt like the world had turned upside down. I had fought so hard to come out of the closet. I'd been an AIDS activist off and on for 25 years. And here I was somehow 25 years later, alienated from the very people that I wanted to be a part of. So I knew that I needed to get to the bottom of my feelings, whatever they were.
Well, let's call in a speech-language pathologist who you consult in the movie, Susan Sankin. Susan, welcome. So from your perspective, well, let me back up a little bit. Was David the first person who came to you hoping you'd help him sound less gay?
No, not at all. The interesting thing, though, was that David was the first person who came to me who was upfront right from the beginning about sounding gay and what he wanted to do. Very typically in the past, the clients that came would say to me, I think I need to improve my articulation or I have an S problem. And after a few sessions when they felt that they could trust me, they would say, you know, by the way, I'm gay. And so I've done this over the years, for many years, and I will say that there were more gay men that came to see me in the past than people who come now. You know, much the way David said in the 80s, it was a little bit tougher to be gay. I think now that in general, especially in New York City, that people are more accepting.
Susan, as a speech and language pathologist, when somebody like David comes to you and says, I'm not comfortable with my voice, I want to change it. In David's case, I want to sound less gay. Do you try to convince them that their authentic voice is fine, or do you automatically try to help them change it? If what they have isn't a pathology per se, like it isn't like, you know, a technical problem that they're having that's interfering with their ability to speak, like a stutter or the kind of lisp that might make it hard to understand what somebody's saying.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't try to dissuade them because when people come to see me, they typically, you know, have reached the point where it's really bothering them and it's interfering with communication. So whether it's somebody that comes because they sound gay or I work a lot with non-native speakers, they're coming because they're very frustrated in their communication abilities and it's preventing them from communicating and from being comfortable. So it's having a big effect on their life and limiting them in a lot of ways. So if they feel that they want to change, to explore their voice, to explore their speech so that they feel more confident, that's where I typically go with them.
If you're just joining us, I have two guests. David Thorpe is the director of the new movie, Do I Sound Gay?, in which he tries to reflect on his voice and see if he wants to change it or not. And Susan Sankin is a speech pathologist who he consults with for some help on his voice. David, as we heard in the opening of your movie, you're on the street interviewing people, asking them, do I sound gay? And so among the answers they give you as well, you sound a little artsy-fartsy. Susan, I want your reaction to that. And David, I want your reaction too.
That was a unique response, clearly.
No, I have heard that from other people. A listener once wrote in describing somebody, I won't say who, as sounding like an art fag. And it's like, well, you got to be kidding, you know? So, like, yeah. I've heard that before.
I also love the guy who says, you sound creative.
That's right.
You know, which was a kind of thinly veiled euphemism once upon a time for gay.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that a lot. I hear you sound academic, you sound educated, you sound creative. My parents were academics. I was, you know, laughed myself the first few times I got the artsy-fartsy thing. I kind of get it, and if that's what I am, great. I'll take it. Slot me in that category.
And we should also acknowledge that there's a whole lot of, like, stereotyped projection onto the interpretation of the sound.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing I always like to emphasize, Terry, is that there is no such thing as a fundamentally gay voice. There is a stereotype, and there are men, to a greater or lesser extent, who embody that stereotype. And for some men, it's not just a stereotype, it's really who they are. And for some gay men, it doesn't apply at all. And it was important to me to put, you know, a very straight-sounding and acting gay man into the movie as well as a more gay-sounding straight man to illustrate that point.
Susan, it's my impression, and I'd like to hear your impression, that there are more and more straight men who are starting to have that sound that is categorized as a gay sound.
I think perhaps that's coming from the trend to embrace upspeak, one of my pet peeves. Mm-hmm. But that tendency to kind of speak in that way where you're going up makes your voice sound a little bit more musical. And I think that's what people associate with a gay sound to some degree.
So you're hearing that more in men and women and in girls and boys.
The upspeak, definitely. Mm-hmm. It's just across genders. It's across age categories. It's an epidemic.
Right. Okay. So, you know, in dealing with David, though, upspeak was one of the things he came to you about. Did you suggest to him that he would sound more authoritative and assertive if he didn't speak that way?
I did, and we did work on that. As a matter of fact, we used the address at Gettysburg, which was a more serious toned piece. And
recite that with upspeak, and let's hear how that would sound.
47 years ago, I don't know if I'm getting this right, our fathers brought forth to this continent a new nation, something to that effect. But I made David very conscious of the punctuation, having his voice go down, thinking about this, you know, the seriousness of this piece. And sometimes it's easier to do a more serious piece, to bring your voice down. And he was able to do it well. I think the hard thing is always to maintain it in conversational speech, especially in a casual social situation. But definitely it's possible. And again, it goes back to awareness. Once you hear it, you're able to change it. But a lot of people just are unaware of it or don't know how to change it. That's with a lot of my clients that come to see me say that they're kind of stuck. And I think David indicated this also, that when he was in high school, he didn't speak that way. And correct me if I'm wrong. But after he came out in college, he started, his speech changed, and he was kind of stuck and didn't know how to change it from where he was when he came to see me.
So, David, during the course of making your movie, Do I Sound Gay?, you ask a lot of people where the gay sound comes from, and then you get some interesting theories about it. Is there a theory you particularly subscribe to now about how the so-called gay voice developed?
If I have to speculate about, you know, where the so-called gay voice comes from, for me, both the most predominant, you know, answers work. One is that as you're acquiring language, you tend to imitate the people you trust and you identify with. And certainly for me, that was a lot of women. I always had a lot of female friends growing up, and I don't think that's atypical for some gay men. At the same time, I totally get that when I came out, I wanted to be recognized as gay. I wanted the world to know I was gay, and I wanted to fit into this existing community. So I think my voice really did change after I came out. So I think that both the language acquisition theory and the kind of community, learned way of speaking hold water. It's kind of impossible to really tangle out, a single reason.
When you were in, I guess, grade school? Was it grade school that you started?
Middle school.
That you started taking speech therapy, that you were put in speech therapy. Let's put it that way. How old were you when you were put in speech therapy?
I was in elementary school when I was put in speech therapy for a lisp. A distortion of my S is what the form says.
And do you think you actually had a lisp, or do you think you were just sounding gay? I'm not sure what language to use for this. Do you think you had a problem that needed to be corrected, or do you think it was social stereotyping that made people think that you had to sound more normative?
You know, that's a great question. It may be that it was a little bit of both. because sometimes I do actually find myself doing the what Susan would call the interdental lisp, so putting my tongue between my teeth so that I say th instead of s. So I think I probably did have a bit of a lisp. And some linguists would say, look, everybody has a lisp, but there's a stereotype out there that gay men have this kind of childlike speech defect, and so gay men tend to think that it has something to do with their being gay. At the same time, it's hard to ignore the preponderance of gay men who tell me they had speech therapy.
A lot of men have told you that. David Sedaris tells you that.
Yeah. He is definitely the most prominent example, and he wrote a wonderful story in his collection, Me Talk Pretty, one day, where he called his speech class, it was a meeting of the future homosexuals of America. I think my linguist friends would probably kill me right now for even entertaining the idea that there's some relationship between an interdental lisp and being gay. But, you know, it's for me, the jury is still out.
There's a part in the movie where you're talking to a high school friend, a woman who you've been friends with since high school. So she knew you when you were young. And she said she felt a little betrayed when you came back from college. You spoke differently. You had more of a gay sound. And to her, that sounded inauthentic because it was a change from how you sounded when she knew you best. And I'm wondering if you heard that difference in your voice and how you reacted to what she told you.
You know, I had never realized that my voice had changed so much until I started making the film and talking to my friends from high school. But once they mentioned it, I completely understood what they were saying, because when I came out, I was so excited to finally have found the courage to come out.
This was in college?
In college, yeah. It was in freshman or sophomore year of college, that I just grabbed every gay symbol I could, whether it was the way I, you know, cut my hair or dressed or the way I sounded or the vocabulary I used. And it made perfect sense to me when my friends told me this is what had happened. And that moment was a painful but ultimately worthwhile moment for me, because it hurt me a little bit when she said that, because I feel like I'm trying to be myself and here she is saying, you're a fake. At the same time, I understood what she was saying, because I myself wasn't comfortable with my voice and I didn't know where it came from and I didn't know why it had changed so much. And I myself was wondering what's my real voice.
David Thorpe is the director of the documentary, Do I Sound Gay? Susan Sankin is a language and speech pathologist. You'll find a longer version of their conversation with Terry Gross, which includes a discussion of the vocal issues upspeak and vocal fry, online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.